this episode of the LDS PMA podcast, Voices of Light. I'm your host, Ted Finch. Today, we'll be visiting with my friend and neighbor, Rob Eaton. Rob and his wife, Diane, have 4 children and 8 grandchildren. Originally from the Seattle area, Rob served a mission in Germany, studied international relations at BYU-Idaho, and earned a law degree from Stanford Law School. He calls his employment history checkered, but full of interesting opportunities, including working as a page in the U.S. Senate for 6 months, as a research assistant for multiple professors at BYU, including John Welch, as an attorney at a big firm in Seattle, and later, a Blue Shield company, as a health insurance executive, as an institute director and seminary teacher, and at BYU-Idaho as a religion professor, as the associate academic vice president for pathway and online learning, and as a mission president, and as the associate academic vice president for learning and teaching. He is currently a professor of religious education and a learning and teaching fellow at BYU-Idaho, and he serves as a stake president. Rob has authored or co-authored multiple books for an LDS audience, including President Eyring's biography, I Will Lead You Along. Rob enjoys grandchildren, most forms of exercise, the outdoors, music, reading, and writing. Well, Rob, I just wanted to welcome you to our podcast today and say thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. And I realize I omitted a critical detail from my biography, which is I can kind of play the accordion. So I thought I should probably add that just right at the outset.
That's good. I've heard stories about the accordion. As I mentioned in the intro, Rob's my neighbor, he lives just down the street, but I've heard stories of him showing up at people's doorsteps playing the accordion. So
yeah, you know, I realized one day when I was on someone's doorstep doing that, that my dad did the same thing. He played the trombone badly. I played the accordion badly. So it's a genetic defect of playing embarrassing instruments or instruments embarrassingly poorly to try to brighten people's lives.
And I think that's actually a great way to start this whole podcast off, because that's really what the theme is sharing our own voice of light, but finding ways to just brighten people's days through the things that we do. And so with that, Rob, the first question I'm going to ask you is, what does it mean to you to be a voice of light?
You know, Paul has a phrase in 2 Corinthians 5 that I love, ambassadors for Christ. To me, when we're a voice of light, it means that we strive to be an instrument in the hands of God, that we put ourselves in play to make the world a better place, to lift people up when their spirits sag. And above all, for me, as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, it means to try to help people find the path that leads to the greatest blessings God has for his children in this life and eternity. I think when you really want to have a voice of light in the most profound sense, you've got that eternal goal in mind for those you're serving.
That's awesome. Thank you. So in addition to the accordion, how has the Lord helped you be a voice of light?
That's a great question. I've had some wonderful mentors and examples throughout my life, and then opportunities. I would say in particular, as I've prayed for opportunities, the Lord has answered those prayers, getting to participate in small little miracles to make someone's day better or help someone come closer to Christ. Builds my faith, leads me to want to pray more, and coincidentally builds my capacity to do that. I hope over time I get better at acting on those opportunities that come to me.
Yeah, and I can share one opportunity. When we first moved into the house that we're in right now, I think you were out running and you saw a moving truck and you just hopped in line with everybody else and started unloading stuff and didn't know us. And I just was really impressed and really grateful just to have the extra help to get things out. So I don't think I ever told you thank you for that. So thank you.
You're welcome. I think it was just inspired by guilt. I thought this is kind of embarrassing. I'm just running in circles and here I could be exercising in a way that would help this new neighbor. That seems like a more productive use of my time.
So one of the, you mentioned in the biography that you worked on President Eyring's book. And so my next question is around that. How did you get involved with the project to write President Eyring's biography? And then along with that, what was it like working on that project?
So the short answer is that I was in a meeting, a President's Council meeting at BYU-Idaho one day, And Henry had told me, Henry, by the way, whenever I say Henry, that's Henry J. Eyring, my co-author and the son of President Eyring, whom I would never call Henry, even if I were on a first name basis, because then you would call him Hal. But Henry just wrote me a note that was one word with a question mark, co-author, question mark. So that's the short answer to how I became a co-author. What led to that, I think, was having become friends with and having worked with Henry. We had team taught a wonderful class together. And then he had introduced me to Elder Hales and working on a different project. And I don't know if that had anything to do with Henry's decision to invite me to be a co-author. I certainly think it helped prepare me to be a co-author. And then your second question was, what was it like? I was blessed to read all of President Eyring's journals, which was an extraordinary thing, and to interview him. I interviewed him about 20 times. And then I interviewed the whole Quorum of the 12, and maybe just as interestingly, some people he'd known from different periods throughout his life. One of my favorite interviews, I can't even remember the guy's name now, he's a billionaire, who's not an active member of the church. He gave one of the strongest witnesses of President Eyring's spiritual growth of any of the people I interviewed. So just getting to interview all those people was delightful. And then Henry was the principal writer. I read and edited and suggested things and highlighted things from the interviews and the talks. So that was my role.
That's awesome. That book has had a huge impact on me, and I shared a note with Henry just about the impact that the book had on me, and I said thank you so much for sharing your dad's story. It made me realize that, you know, as we talk about having a mentor in life, that it doesn't have to necessarily be someone that we see face to face or that we talk to. It can be someone in a book. And there were different experiences that President Eyring had throughout his life that really just hit home to me. And I'm like, oh, wow, I need to be a little better. Or, wow, I've had a similar experience to that. And it really changed me. And I've got a copy of it here. And so I asked him, I said, please pass this message along to your dad that I really appreciate that he was willing to let this story be shared. And so thank you to you too. It had a big impact on me. It gave me another channel to help me focus on how to be a better person. So thank you for that.
Ted, may I just echo one of the things you said there? As I was working on this project, I was listening to a book on audio, an audio book of President Eyring's, and he'd read it himself. And I just love his voice. And as I was listening to it, I thought, I feel as I listen to this exactly like I feel when I sit in his presence. And it occurred to me that really we live in an extraordinary day and age when we can listen to the actual voices or read the written words of all sorts of people. We don't have to be lucky enough to be blessed to be a co-author of a biography of someone we admire. And I have been similarly blessed by studying the biographies of presidents of the church and Elder Maxwell and others. So I think that reading and studying biographies, and as well as doing what I did, I read every conference talk and every other talk published anywhere by President Eyring. And I did the same thing with Elder Hale's work. That opportunity is available to anyone. And we get great blessings when we do just focus on the teachings and lives of consecrated disciples, whether or not they hold a prominent position in the church.
That's great. And you mentioned something like when I listen to, if I'm not listening to one of the talks, I start to hear their voice. If I'm just reading it, I'll hear it in their voice. So it's like they're there, and it's a remarkable and just touching experience. And so you've talked a couple times about Elder Hales, and we've talked a little bit about this. What role did you have, or tell us a little bit about the book project you worked on with Elder Hales.
So Henry had wanted to do actually a biography of Elder Hales in the mode that we ended up doing with his father, which was kind of an unusual biography because we integrated many of his teachings into the biography. And Elder Hales was very kind and gracious, but just not comfortable doing it. And yet he said he'd been meaning to write a book, that Elder President Kimball and President Hinckley had asked him to write a book, and he had been hanging over his head for years. And so I started to help. And what we did was take all of his teachings and then kind of organize them thematically. And then use his, he loves 2 Nephi 31. It's one of his favorite chapters of scripture, along with John 17. And but he loves the covenant path. He loves the path that extends from premortality to life after death. And he's got just a wonderful sweeping vision. So we took his writings and kind of chunked them up and repackaged them, drawing from parts of different talks along that organizational scheme. And then I interviewed him. Henry had told me he had a bunch of great stories that he had never told in conference. And it's true. One of them, Elder Maxwell had said, you know, Bob, if you're not going to use this, let me use this. This is a great story. But he held on to it. And so there were many stories that were shared in the book for the first time. But his rule was it couldn't be a biography. It couldn't just be something that made him look good. Instead, it could only be used if it helped illuminate a principle or doctrine. So I ended up interviewing him and working together with him to compile his words and weave together some stories with excerpts from previous talks in a blended way that truly was a new creation, even though it drew from his previous works.
One thing that came to my mind as you were talking about that is, and I think you're a great example of this, as being available when the opportunity comes around, if the Lord has something for us to do. Because you could have easily gotten intimidated and be like, wow, to, you know, help write a book about President Eyring or about Elder Hales. I mean, that could be intimidating, but I think you're a great example of being willing to take, you know, step into an opportunity when the Lord opens the door.
I tell you, by the way, it was intimidating. Where I come from, there's one guy who'd been a mission president. We practically built a shrine to him. We weren't friends with general authorities and weren't related to him. It was so walking into that world was a strange thing for me. And they were both so gracious and so welcoming. But I remember more than one person I interviewed for the Eyring biography asked, so how are you? How'd you end up being a co-author? And I would just laugh out loud and say, I'm asking myself the same question, but I've just been blessed with some wonderful opportunities. And one of Elder Hale's teachings was, and I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but basically that you will get some opportunities in life and you want to make the most of those important opportunities so that the Lord will give you more. And so I definitely felt that responsibility with both of these opportunities. They felt very sacred to me.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. And this next question kind of ties into the point you just shared. And it's, when was a moment that you finally just decided to take a leap and share your voice? And then what impact did that have on you?
You know, I don't know that I wish. I don't have such a moment. And I guess it's like the development of testimonies, how many people have such a moment, and for others, it came drop by drop, so there's no specific time they can point to. But I shared the gospel probably inappropriately at school as a kid. And so I can't really remember a time where that wasn't part of my makeup. But I will say that with my mission, things probably shifted. I'm embarrassed to admit that if I'd been really honest in an interview before my mission, I would have said, yeah, celestial kingdom and exaltation are my goal. And yeah, live so that you can qualify for that. But now let's talk about what secular things I want to accomplish. What do I want to do for a career? And I would have had much more of my excitement there. My mission president is the person, Richard Klein, who really helped me see myself in subtle but yet profoundly different ways. For him, Carol Thomas at BYU once said, and I'm paraphrasing, redemption isn't just another thing going on in the universe. It's the thing going on in the universe. For me, my mission president and my mission helped me see that the work of salvation and exaltation should be the thing going on in my life. That whatever else I might accomplish secularly, academically, those were all kind of frosting on the cake and sometimes even necessary means to gospel ends, but that my purpose here in life was not to be a highly successful lawyer or attain political office. My purpose should be God's purpose, to help others come unto Christ by having faith in him, repenting, receiving the gift, being baptized, receiving the gift of the Holy Ghost, and enduring to the end. So that helped me, my mission. In fact, along those same lines, I will say, because I was pretty politically active when I was younger, and I still follow politics closely, but there can be some temptation for a few members of the church to focus so much on what's wrong culturally with the church that they want to fix, that they don't focus as much on establishing Zion. So for me, my goal after my mission and over my life became to build Zion, to establish Zion rather than trying to fix Zion. And certainly if I see people being insensitive or unkind based on race or sexual orientation or anything like that, I'd personally try to model a better behavior. But I've tried not to get caught up in fixing something I think is wrong with the church and made my life's mission to build Zion. So that's been a gradual thing, but if there were a turning point where it became more pronounced and my focus became more sharpened, it would have been my first mission.
Great. The next question, I've got a couple of quotes from President Ballard that he shared in 1995 at a festival for Mormon arts. And the first one, President Ballard talked about how we need to make our voices heard. Back in 1995, and I think this is still relevant today, why is that idea important of making our voices heard?
As followers of Jesus Christ and as members of his church, I think we've got some unique things to offer the world. And especially in a time, at least in this country, and I think in the world, of greater polarization and less civility. And as people also are losing belief in God. The drop in the number of American adults who identify them as Christians from themselves as Christians from 2007 in the United States to 2014 was dramatic, like 7 or 8 points. This is a time when people are losing faith and losing unity. I think as members of the church, we can follow President Nelson's example and do so much to work together with other good people in the world to say things in positive ways that may help some people who might have been losing their faith some, or help others who might have becoming really hardened in their partisanship and polarization, strike a more civil tone and be more understanding of people with different ideas.
Thank you. This next question, President Ballard also mentioned, with so many choices, our work not only needs to be uplifting, it must be excellent, to set it apart from the mediocre of the worldly. Why do you think excellence is so important as we share our voices?
Let's see if I can find this quote. I had it in advance. Here it is. This is something that Elder Bednar said when he was president of BYU Idaho, so just President Bednar, in 1999. And he was quoting Elder Richard L. Evans. He said, "You know, it's a wonderful thing to be faithful, but a much greater thing to be both faithful and competent. There is no particular virtue in being uninformed, certainly no virtue in ignorance. When young people can acquire the skills, the techniques, and the knowledge of these times, and along with it have a spiritual commitment and a solid faith and cleanliness of life, there is nothing that you can't achieve, nothing in righteousness or in reason." Whether you're posting something on Facebook or writing a book, or for that matter, talking with someone privately on an airplane in conversation, the more we develop our spiritual and secular gifts, the more powerful instruments we become in the Lord's hands.
I like that. And thank you for tying it into everything we do, not just whether we're writing a book, we're doing a podcast or a blog or, you know, a YouTube video, but it's just the conversations we have and having that balance of, you know, spiritual strength and also secular strength. Elder, in another talk, I don't remember if it's in that same one with President Ballard, but it might be. No, it's from, I can't remember his name right now, but the idea behind it was, we can't, it was Elder Maxwell. We can't just develop our creative gifts. We have to develop our spiritual gifts. We have to do it together. Can't do them separately. We won't see the growth that we could if we are only focusing on our creative. We have to do the creative and the spiritual together. So my next question is, what's been the biggest challenge you've faced creatively so far?
Well, it's hard to say, but it may have been working on the book with Elder Hales. We had the outline and the chapter headings. But I remember sitting down at the beginning of each one of them and feeling like I was looking at a mountain of quotes and trying to figure out how do I organize this? Where do we put stuff? And I went to the temple a lot and got wonderful, clear direction there that really helped me work through that creative challenge.
Now, I know a writer isn't the only thing that you are, the only thing that you do, but it is one of the many things that you do. When you do put on that writer hat, what's your goal as a writer?
That's a good question, because I write some very different kinds of things. Right now, I'm just wrapping up with my colleagues and friends, Steve Hunsaker and Bonnie Moon, a book for a secular audience, for college professors and maybe other teachers, on tentatively called Helping, Not Hindering, how professors can make life better for students with mental health challenges. So my goal with that book is completely different than another project I'm working on, kind of an in-house book for new BYU-Idaho teachers, something that's gathering all that we've learned about teaching. And those goals were different than my goals in writing my own books for an LDS audience. When I'm writing for an LDS audience, I guess my goal is to try to help people come closer to Christ and more fully realize their divine potential. With the other book, it's to help teachers to stop doing things that they might not realize are making life harder for, inadvertently making life harder for some of their students with depression and anxiety, and start doing some things or do more of some things that are actually really helping students a lot. So I want to make the world a better place by helping those students, by helping their professors. I'd have to say that for me, when I write, I sat down 3 or 4 years ago when I got back from my mission, and I hadn't written in a while. So I started to write something, and it didn't come tumbling out. For me, every one of my books have come tumbling out. And so I felt like if it wasn't tumbling out, then it wasn't what I needed to be doing yet. So I've not been especially proactive in charting any course for myself as a writer or setting goals. Instead, I've sort of followed what's come to me and the opportunities that have come to me and tried to make the most of them.
That's really good advice on, I think, coming to know who yourself as a writer, as a creative, knowing when you're kind of in, I'll just call it the zone or in a rhythm, you know when you're doing things in the way that work. And it can... And you're not the only person I've heard talk about this. They can tell when it's a project they need to keep pursuing, or when it's, I don't need to work on this now or ever or yet. But there's a difference with that. And I notice that in my own writing sometimes. There's actually a piece I'm working on right now, and it's not long. It's only supposed to be like 500 words. But I've sat down, and I've gone through 4 different attempts of starting. I'm like, nope, that's not the right path. Nope, that one's not right either. And it's been interesting I've asked myself, do I even need to write this? And so being in tune with kind of where we're going, I think is an important point that you hit.
I will say too, by way of creative advice, when something starts to come, then you ride that wave and then keep writing until you run out of time or run out of ideas. But because there are those times where you get writer's block or things just don't come naturally. Sometimes I'll even shift to a part of a project, a book or whatever I'm working on, where it does feel like it's flowing, and that'll kind of get me going, get me in a groove. And then it's easier to come back to a different part once I've gotten a better rhythm.
Thank you. Our next question, What are three things that you think will help our listeners be stronger voices of light?
Well, two come to mind, and let's see if, as I'm talking about them, a third comes to mind. And the two may seem to point in opposite directions. So the first is a change, I would say, I made between my first mission and my second mission as a mission leader with my wife in terms of how I shared the gospel. In my first mission, if I'd encountered someone who said, well, so the very first night that we knocked on doors as a mission resident couple, I went out with a young man and my wife and my son. They both went out with other missionaries because Elder Bednar had told us to do that. And it was a good thing. I remember a man saying, I'm good. I found Jesus. And, you know, as a young missionary, my inclination would have been to go right to priesthood authority or ordinances or baptism and talk about what was deficient in his faith, what he needed. But as hopefully a more seasoned and maybe more understanding older person, I said, that is great news. Do you mind telling me, how did you find Christ? And he told me, he was in prison. And then I said, how has that blessed your life? How has finding Jesus Christ changed your life for good? We talked for a while. He opened up. I came to understand him much better. And then I testified that God had sent us to give him even more light and truth. He didn't get baptized, but it was a much better encounter than I would have had with that same man as a younger missionary. And I followed that pattern throughout my mission, and I do it now. And so the principle, I guess, would be to really take the time to understand people and their perspectives and look for some common ground and build on common truth before immediately jumping to points of disagreement. My second thought then that might seem to point in a different direction is to use what Elder Richards, General Authority Emeritus, quoted from one of his ancestors, Willard Richards, and he just mentions it in his journal. He said, I taught the brethren about holy boldness when he was a missionary in England. And the Elder Richards from our day told us what he thought that phrase meant. That became a catchphrase in our mission. And in my life, my missionaries and I, we like to think that it's love that puts the holiness in boldness. And if you're bold without truly caring about other people, it doesn't work. But when you love other people and they sense it and you care about them and you listen to them, then at some point you say, as I did to this man on the door, do you know the story of Cornelius? He didn't. I told him that he reminded me of Cornelius, a wonderful God-fearing man who prayed and was commanded to send for messengers from God. And Peter showed up and taught him things he did not yet know that brought him even more happiness and blessings. In that case, he taught him about Jesus Christ. I testified that we had been sent by Jesus Christ to teach him things of eternal consequence. That's boldness, and I hope holy boldness. The adversary, I think, works really hard to get us either to be totally silent or to be so muted in our attempts to help others that it doesn't do much good. I think the more clearly we see things from an eternal perspective, the more willing we are to do things like share the gospel with strangers or invite a loved one to make a change in our life that will lead to greater blessings. So those are the two. I struck out on number three, but try to understand people better, and yet exercise what Elder Richards called holy boldness.
So you talked about two projects that have really had an impact on you from the President Eyring book and the Elder Hale's book. What are your biggest takeaways on those?
In both cases, as I got to study their lives and their writings over the course of their lives, I saw growth. That's what Elder Maxwell said to Bruce Hafen, Elder Hafen. He hoped that he'd grown, and he hoped that growth would be evident in the biography. And I love that biography because it's wonderfully candid. You see the impatience in the young Elder Maxwell. Well, in a young Elder Hales, I saw competitiveness, a great drive to succeed secularly. He would do an all-nighter once a week as a young executive. And yet, when I drew from one of his earlier writings, and there was a phrase that said something like, when I was president of Schick Gillette at age 33, and as we read that together, he said, no, take that out. And I knew I had anticipated that objection. And so I said, no, it's relevant here. You're not boasting. It's relevant here because of, and I can't remember what my reasons were. We went back and forth for a while, and because it was his book and he's an apostle, he won. And all he would let us put in was when I was a young executive. That is an apostolic transformation. He was sensitive to the fact that being a top 5% fighter pilot and going to Harvard Business School and being a young executive, that these might not be inspiring to some people. These might be intimidating. And so he was very careful in how he used those things. He didn't want to do anything that would call attention unduly to himself. Similarly, President Eyring hated having any attention drawn to himself. One of the first things he said was, I can't tell whether to make you wait 10 years or 50 years after my death to let you publish this. He could barely say the word biography. Once he was calling somebody from the church history department when I was asking if we could get something, and he couldn't say it. He couldn't say, my son Henry and Rob are working on a biography. He said, they're working on this, you know, that this project. To me, that was inspiring. That kind of humility, that really trying to get out of the spotlight and make sure that they weren't standing between others and the Savior, but instead were always pointing others to the Savior. The second thing from President Eyring's life that really stood out to me, maybe because it's something that I need to work on myself, is that as a very successful, task-oriented young president of Frick's College, he needed his home teacher to be in tune with the Spirit, to tell him he needed to get up from behind his desk and walk the campus and talk to people. In fact, as you read in the book, that his home teacher came a second time with that message because he wasn't doing it. And I remember his journal entry for that day. I can't even remember if we've got it in the book. I think we do. But he said, I got up and I went and I had some good conversations, but I didn't get very much done. You could tell this was a hard shift for him to make. Success was crossing things off a long list of action items. Fast forward decades to a time that I brought my daughter Danielle with me to meet him during one of our interviews. And I was a little sheepish. I think I'd asked for permission. I hope I had. And so I just wanted to introduce her, let her meet him, and then have her go on her way so that she wasn't taking up some of his precious time and our precious limited time together. But he kept asking her questions. And kept her in there for like 15 minutes. And, we're transparent to them. He could see right through me. So when she left, he explained. And he said, you know, I was just poking to see if there was anything that I might be able to help with in some way. That is an apostolic transformation in his life, going from being laser focused on getting as many tasks as possible accomplished to being patiently flexible and in tune with the Spirit and so focused on others' needs that you've somehow tuned out the mountain of tasks he must have had to do that day as a member of the First Presidency.
Those are great. Thank you for sharing those. We're down to our last two questions.
I hope I don't run in those circles except for these books. I hope I haven't violated any rules by sharing these details, but for me, they're illuminating.
And thank you so much. So our last two questions. One is, why is networking and collaboration so important?
Well, let me first address collaboration and then give you a heretical answer on networking. I think collaboration is so important because even though it can be challenging sometimes to do things together with other people instead of just doing them alone, the result is almost always better when we collaborate. Even if you're producing something solo, by just giving it to other people and letting them give you feedback. And Henry Eyring is great at doing this. He does this with all his books. He sends them out to lots of people and lets people give feedback. He invites that feedback. I've learned from his example in that regard that there is real power in humbly soliciting input from others and real synergy when we get one of those rare opportunities to truly collaborate with someone else. As for networking, I've never been a conscious networker, but I've done things that have, I guess, accomplished the same purpose. But I've never just cultivated a relationship with someone and then taken them out to lunch in hopes that if I needed a reference for a job or something like that, they would do that for me. But if somebody's interesting to me and we have stuff to talk about, I've invited them to lunch and we've gone to lunch, or they've invited me and we've done it, or we've struck up friendships and conversations. And I guess the result is that I have networks, but I think networks of genuine friends and colleagues. I just got yesterday feedback from the latest book from a wonderful, from Michelle Miller, who's now a new friend and colleague to me. She came and spoke here at BYU Idaho last year. We were talking and somehow I mentioned my book and she mentioned that she'd be willing to read it. And so she did. She took the time to review the manuscript and it was such wonderful feedback. And I've offered to return the favor. There wasn't anything in that relationship where I thought, what if I did this and I could then get ahead in that way. And I'm not implying that anyone who networks is always thinking that, but I have found that when people come and ask me for things, when they're genuine in their interest, I'm much more likely to engage with them and give back than if I feel like they've got just kind of utilitarian motives.
I think that's a great insight to share. And that's the reason I love this question is we get so many different viewpoints from people on what networking is to them. And it sometimes it challenges what we typically think of networking. And so I like what you shared about just that genuineness in that connection rather than just as a way to lift you to something else. Last question, Rob, what's next for you?
Well, as I mentioned, we're wrapping up work on this book that's going to be published by West Virginia University Press. And I don't know what will come from that, but I think it may be filling a void, a need in higher education. And so I'm hoping, I've been blessed with some opportunities to speak about that book at BYU Idaho, and maybe eventually elsewhere I'll get opportunities as well. And then I've shifted from being an associate academic vice president for learning and teaching to returning to the religion faculty, but also getting a little bit of leave each semester to be a learning and teaching fellow. So I team teach with my wonderful friends and colleagues, Sid Palmer and Brian Schmidt, a course we call the Progressing Teaching Course that all new faculty members take, a semester-long course at BYU Idaho. So over the course of this year, I hope to essentially write the textbook. I'm about six chapters into that effort. And when I finish that, and those two books are behind me, I've got 50 pages of another book done that I hope to submit to Deseret Book on intentionality. And that was a book that was tumbling out. It was hard to stop, but I felt like these other two books were higher priorities. I'm 57. I never know what is in store for me, but what I'd like to do is teach to the end of my career here at BYU Idaho, and maybe get to continue to be a voice for improving the way we teach and engaging in the scholarship of learning and teaching at BYU Idaho, and someone who collaborates more with people from other schools and outside our faith. As I researched this book with Steve and Bonnie, wow, we found such great scholarship out there. Earlier in my career, I wrote a book on, co-authored a book with Mark Beecher on teaching in the gospel. I wish I had taken advantage of the great secular scholarship out there, not to contradict anything we were saying, but to give it more credibility and more traction. So in that book I'm doing internally for BYU Idaho, now I get to do that. So I'm looking forward to a season of fulfilling the vision that Elder Bednar had for BYU Idaho, in which we become a light on the hill in the scholarship of learning and teaching as we collaborate internally more, taking seriously the work of others, but then mashing it up with our access to gifts of the Spirit and focusing like, I'll just put in this plug for BYU Idaho. I've been to conferences with other people who had responsibility for teaching and learning at their universities. And one woman said, you know, I'm at a so-called teaching college, but our administration doesn't really care about teaching. How do you get the administration to really care about the quality of teaching? And Brian Schmidt and I almost laughed out loud. And we had to be careful not to come across as too smug, but we were thinking it is at the forefront of the minds of our university presidents and the religious leaders of our sponsoring institution. It's what we're about. So BYU Idaho is a place where I think we are uniquely positioned to really dive into how we can help students learn more and then share what we learn with the world. I hope I get to do some of that in this the sunset of my career.
Thank you so much, Rob. What I really appreciated with what you shared in that last question was you highlighted one of the things I love about this podcast is that we get to meet people from all sorts of different careers, backgrounds, interests, and we get to see how they're a voice of light in the different spheres of influence in their life. The things that you're doing with BYU Idaho in partnering with others, you're writing about how to be a better teacher, but that light that you carry shines out. And that's the thing that I hope listeners always remember is there's lots of different ways to be a voice of light. The things that you'll hear people talk about doesn't have to be the way that you're doing it. You find the way that works best for you. And I just wanted to thank you so much for joining us today and taking the time to talk. It's been a great conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
But just to build on what you said, I agree completely. I love the story of Bezalel in Exodus 31. After Moses is given the instructions from the Lord about really the specs for the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant, it's directions that would have been completely overwhelming to me as a non-mechanically inclined person. The Lord gives the good news to Moses that he's prepared Bezalel and some of his buddies to build this, that he's given them those gifts, apparently completely different gifts than Moses had. Both were necessary for the construction of those sacred things, Moses' skills and Bezalel's skills and his friend's skills. And I think what you said is completely true, that each one of us has been given some gifts and opportunities unique to us. If we're willing and we step forward, God will use us and we can become voices of light and forces for good.
Thank you so much.